Hi everyone, welcome to our latest ILS NYC 2021 event broadcast. Please visit the event website, have a look at our sponsors, without who we couldn't put on these events. And you'll be able to view all of the video content there once the conference is over. It's all archived there for your viewing pleasure. So we continue to look at the development of the insurance and securities market with an eye towards the future. And as we've been saying, we're trying to define the future of the next generation of the sector. But it's also really important to think about what's going on right now. Obviously, the world is still in the grip of a pandemic, which in some areas of the world is getting much better. In other areas, it continues to be a real concern. And for this broadcast, I'm delighted to be joined again by Tom Johansmeyer, head of PCS, part of the Verisk Group of Companies, and also our headline sponsor for the event. Thanks for joining me, Tom.
Steve, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about the pandemic, what the ongoing pandemic means for ILS and the reinsurance market more broadly, get Tom's latest views on this and think about how this could affect the industry over the coming months and also the years ahead. And let's jump right into it. PCS has not designated COVID-19 as a catastrophe event. Perhaps you could explain why. I'm sure that's something that people in the industry are asking themselves.
Yeah, it's come up a lot since the middle of March last year, and it's continued to come up, which I found really interesting. So we announced really early on, probably late March, that COVID would not be declared a PCS designated catastrophe for the simple fact that we have a defined list of storm families and perils and communicable disease, infectious disease, pandemic. Nothing close to that is in there. You know, we also do not have a catch-all category like miscellaneous or other, because what that does is effectively invalidates the structure, right? If I give you a list of 10 or 20 or 30 things, then I say this is the universe, you can do some serious, predictable, and effective due diligence on that. But the minute I add that 31 that is other, it basically means anything comes in. So by allowing that sort of catch-all, we'd effectively allow non-affirmative pandemic risk into the ILW market, which doesn't make any sense. You know, we contemplated like how we could do this going forward, you know, as a successor modification, I guess, to COVID, right? So going forward without including COVID. And the big challenge there is the classes of business that would be included. We're still learning what's being affected. I mean, obviously, there's a discussion around property and BI. We've seen programs business hit. We've seen marine hit. We've seen rumblings of a D&O impact. We've heard possibilities of a GL or an environmental impact. But right now, it's like, what are the covers we're talking about? It's all over the map, and it's still not well-defined. So for now, we figure it makes the most sense to leave this as the outlier as it is, stick to our mission and make sure the folks who have done, you know, decades of research and effort on understanding PCS continue to have that effort respected.
Mm. Do you think people are asking you because they're interested in the data that you might be able to provide, or because they're desperate for hedging opportunities going forwards?
I think it's both of those and also knee jerk. I mean, you know what catastrophes are like, right? You know, the first thing you do after you crash is buy a helmet. And commercially, the tough part for us is, you know, let's say we were going to go forward with a communicable disease coverage index, right? The problem we'd have is, okay, we have to go out, get all the data, it's wide scope, we have to define the universe, and during the pandemic and maybe even shortly after, you know, hopefully we'll get to that point soon, you'll have a certain amount of effort and enthusiasm, but that wanes. And we need to know that we can report on it when it happens next. If that's 10, 20, 30 years from now, there's a lot of kind of reporting risk between now and then. And the big issue would be keeping people interested in supporting us on the data side, validating somehow that support. And then also commercially, I mean, it's a broad effort. It's a lot of effort. It's a resource intensive effort. And, you know, 10 years from now, if nothing happens in between, you know, what sort of financial commitment would the market make to maintaining that kind of index? Yeah, commercially, it doesn't seem all that realistic. So, you know, we're focused right now on the day-to-day risk and capital management issues the industry's having and finding either industry loss index or other data sets that we can harness to help them address those problems more effectively.
Yeah, it's a really difficult issue to get your heads around and to get the data around in a quick and easy manner. And there's a lack of historical data, obviously, as well. But you mentioned how broad the impact's been across insurance and reinsurance lines and the fact that we maybe don't even know where it's all going to come from in future as well in terms of losses. We've been tracking them, obviously, and somewhere over 30 billion of loss announcements and IBNR disclosures among major P&C and life writers so far. It's still well under where initial industry estimates were. Some of the analysts have lowered their industry estimates for COVID, so they look a bit more realistic now, but we're still only 50% of the way towards the bottom of their ranges. How do you think this plays out over time? Do you think we're going to see an eventual industry loss that could be up around the levels Lloyd's had been suggesting, for example?
We could, but not for the reasons they'd expect. You know, so when you saw estimates coming out last summer, for example, there's no time horizon attached to the duration of the event, right? It was it first wave? Was it second wave? A concept of waves now that's not even being discussed all that much. Does it contemplate different strains? Does it contemplate multiple years of direct pandemic impact? You know, my working assumption has been the estimates we saw last year were based on a 12-month horizon. I'm just using that kind of as a marker, right? Or call it they were, you know, contemplative of a first wave, where the second wave would be additive to that. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, it would mean, you know, that, you know, $60,000 or $70,000 estimate might come down to $30,000 or $40,000. But now we have another year or two or whatnot that could raise that back up to a 70 or 80. So, you know, in a way, those estimates could turn out to be right for the wrong reasons. I think D&O is probably the wild card in all this, because those, you know, any impact in that market would take years to sort out, and they could become quite substantial. You know, likewise, some of the trade credit and surety transactions that are out there, smaller market, but some big impacts. You know, we've got to see, you know, how shareholders in some cases are going to view exposure to COVID relative to company strategy and whether or not those strategies were, you know, sufficiently, you know, deep to address the risk of a systemic issue like a pandemic, or if they should have even had to have been, right? So the variables are all over the place for the big numbers. You know, contingency business kind of event kind of on and off, right? You know, the Olympics were seen as a total loss, then they weren't. Japan said they'd go forward without a vaccine. Now that seems to be up for discussion again as well. So, you know, that's several billion dollars of loss right there. My feeling is that if the numbers do get high, it'll be because of duration of the pandemic rather than any sort of spot severity.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. It's interesting that you mentioned shareholders actually as well, because that's an area I haven't really thought about, the potential ramifications going forward, because obviously companies have been buoyed by governments printing money to a degree. Yeah. At some point, this has to stop as well or tail off. Stock markets are currently doing very well, so generally shareholders are very happy. If that reverses, suddenly you could see a wave of interest in analysing how companies have performed, which obviously drives all sorts of ramifications for D&O and other areas of insurance further down the line. We've just been through the January renewals. What did you hear? How did pandemics feature there? I know obviously the broad exclusions are being put into place, but Was it a major feature of negotiations, do you think?
Not from what we heard. I mean, it came up, it was excluded. It didn't sound like it was unexpected or difficult to attain, at least from the conversations I had after the fact. I think the bigger issues out there are probably around capital availability and uncertainty. If you've got, a bucket of cash, you don't know how much of that you may need for, reserving or unexpected losses or anything in a COVID environment, even if not directly attributable to the pandemic, but some of the knock-on effects that could, cause or exacerbate loss as well. We're seeing that in the, onshore and offshore markets right now. The Lotte Chemical loss in South Korea about a year ago, as we understand, had some loss creep due to COVID issues. And we've heard a little bit about that with Golden Ray as well. So the fact that, your capital may have to do things you don't normally expect it to, has an impact on capital availability, which has an impact on rates and terms. That's I'm not telling anybody here anything they don't know. But that's probably what we really saw coming out of it.
Sure. Yeah, no, it seems much more disciplined renewal than perhaps some people had been expecting as well towards the end, even though capital did begin to come in quite large quantities in some cases. But what do you think the implications of changes in insurance and reinsurance contracts are going to be for the ILS market further down the line?
It's a tough call. I mean, I think back in late September, early October, we were looking for a market that didn't even need those changes yet, right? There was a broad expectation that UNL retro wouldn't exist. It'd be an ILW market. Cat bonds would have to flood the market in order to fill the gaps. You would have an increased importance in ILS capacity to kind of mop up those areas where traditional UNL retro wasn't coming to bear. And then what happened? I mean, we saw a lot of startups come into the market with, plenty of capital and clean loss histories and fresh expectations and good talent. I mean, read Artemis. There are big names moving around right now, especially to some of these startups. So that sort of market dynamic definitely has an impact on what you're able to accomplish at 1/1, which ultimately meant that, all right, some of the concern or excitement, depending on which side of the equation you're on in early October, was somewhat muted by 1/1. And it looks like, that could persist for a while, in terms of kind of dramatic moves or dramatic, changes or surprises. The folks I'm talking to say that's probably, out of play by now. It's really more about kind of incremental changes, be it to rates or terms or kind of allocation strategies as opposed to, a complete sea change.
Sure. No, it does seem like there's some possibly fairly sustainable improvement in quality of portfolios, I guess, rather than not necessarily return potential, because obviously returns are never guaranteed. But with the combination of firming rates, more exclusions, having revisited terms over two or three renewals now in the ILS market around some of the structures and collateral and things like that, the potential returns and the quality of the portfolios must be improving, which obviously is good for the investor base and hopefully good for the industry for more sustainable profits as well. Obviously, catastrophe events aside. What about the trapped collateral issue, which I know is something we discussed back in November time, I think it was, in quite a lot of detail. And obviously, people were very nervous about what might happen. And then seemingly that shifted to the end of January rather than the renewal itself. Now we're into February, and I'm still not hearing a great deal about there having been significant trapping. What have you been hearing?
I'm hearing more trapping chatter around Jebby still than I am about COVID.
Right.
There are still some outstanding issues from the 2018 Japanese events, And honestly, COVID trapping may come up in passing on occasion, but I still hear about Jebby trapping at least weekly.
Mm.
Here we are, you know, a year and a half later.
Yeah, that's interesting. So do you think maybe at this renewals, instead of pursuing the ability to trap capital, people were much more focused on getting renewals at better terms, perhaps, and getting continuity with their partners and not having to go back to market, looking for more people to fill up their programs?
Possibly, but I have heard about trapping from other events as well. Events, you know, from U.S. storm season. So I don't think trapping goes away. You know, when you think of kind of, you know, the push and pull between cedent and market in a collateralized environment, you know, you're always going to, whichever side you're on, look for the levers that are advantageous to you. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that perspective at a high level, right? Everyone's going to act in their own self-interest. I mean, that's ultimately what economists beg for. Part of that self-interest will be finding ways to, you know, tilt things in your favor, like being able to trap capital. So if there are levers that are being removed or ranges that are being tightened, I mean, there's, you know, there's always something else that could pop up later. So I don't think trapping necessarily goes away, nor could it really in a collateralized environment.
Yeah. Yeah, but it certainly doesn't seem to have been the issue that people had feared sort of midway through last year, which is which is encouraging, because I think it does suggest that cedents were realistic as well as managers perhaps about this, and looked more at continuity of partnerships rather than potentially contentious trapping on programs that probably weren't going to trigger or we had no visibility of them triggering. So back to COVID on the loss side, I mean, one of the interesting things that's beginning to come through is the longer tail elements. So there was a report recently that in California, there's a lot of employers' liability claims, something like 20% of the claims in the last quarter of the year were COVID related or something, and that elevated the number of claims seen in California workers' comp. Do you think that's something that's going to start accelerating over time?
That's difficult, right? I mean, so it's going to follow kind of how each state works, in addition to their COVID exposure and their population. I mean, you know, California is always, you know, seemingly identified as, you know, the, you know, problem child or the big deal or the opportunity. Why? Because the population's massive, the land area is massive, and as an entity, it's inherently incredibly diverse. I mean, California could be its own country and still be a pretty big one. You know, it's worth keeping that in mind. As to the other 49 states, I mean, things will vary, right? I mean, you know, you've got a state like Florida, which has unique issues that this industry is no stranger to, particularly on the cat side or post-cat. You know, New York's a massive state with unique issues. Texas is a massive state with its own culture. So I think the answer to your question would probably come in more than 50 parts. And that's if we're just talking about the US.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Florida, because obviously that's where social inflation and sort of legal case issues have been a factor in recent hurricane seasons. And something I've started to notice, and this is here in the UK, is advertising from law firms looking for people to pick up cases to do with catching COVID in a certain way or COVID exposure at work. Or if you feel that you weren't protected by your employer, you should join our lawsuit kind of thing. So I'm guessing that's going to be a factor as well going forwards.
It's not like you guys learned that from us, though.
It's
the whole Ministry of Justice portal in the motor third party market, you know, came from cases of liability, an upsurge of liability claims relative to, you know, presumably weaker necks in the UK. So yeah, and there's always a litigation angle, and when there's a litigation angle, there's an advertising opportunity. You know, that situation is no different from the billboards in Florida and Texas, or the, you know, the 30-second advertising spots on TV that are, you know, have very little production value but are designed for direct response purposes.
Yeah, and then obviously the litigation funding investment market also comes into play, which is another interesting dynamic that I think probably was responsible for quite a lot of the creep seen in Florida, because that market was exploding at the time. Do you think that things like employers' liability claims, workers' comp claims, further down the line could then translate into D&O and E&O claims on executives in charge potentially and that sort of thing?
We're going pretty far outside my area of focus. Difficult for me. When I look to D&O, I think more along the classic underlying factors within a COVID environment are probably sufficient fodder for folks to do a little analysis and pay attention to market dynamics.
Yeah. But overall, I think the tail risk just runs, and we have no real clarity on how long that can run for with this, particularly as the pandemic obviously persists as well. So maybe if we switch gears and think about fundraising, obviously, initially we saw a locking up of capital and secondary cap on trading drying up back in April or March or April. But then since then, obviously it recovered quite strongly. We saw a record cap bond year. We've seen a lot of new money coming into the market around 1-1. A report just this week that Nephila raised somewhere around $1 billion of new subscriptions for 2021. So it seems like the pandemic shock might be over on that side. But do you think there'll be some volatility potentially if there's any surprises in particular in the US?
Yeah, talk to me on June 1st, right? I mean, you know, we've got the pandemic issue, which is certainly far from finished or resolved, but with, you know, going on a year's worth of experience in it, with it in our daily lives, it's become a fact of life that we're all accepting now. So it's reduced the shock value and thus, you know, could conceivably have resulted in some muting of volatility. Okay, I get that. I always have a nagging feeling that there's another shoe waiting to drop, but I'm a New Yorker, so I live that way. I mean, it's just part of the cynicism of my heritage. But I do wonder, like, okay, you know, the market has been volatile, but, you know, there is still hasn't been, you know, the big decline. And there are reasons for that, I get, you know. The grocery, for example, has had a strong year. You know, hospitality's gotten hit. Okay. I mean, you when you look below the big picture and you take things sector by sector, a series of different stories emerge economically. Okay, cool. I can wrap my head around that. Even if we wind up in this kind of comfortable purgatory with COVID, you know, we still have hurricane season coming. You know, we still have the risk of big hail, which, you know, we've become accustomed to. You know, those factors alone could have plenty of potential for surprise. Last year, it was the number of hurricanes that surprised us, but you know the drill. I mean, one big one has an impact.
Yeah. And this year being a La Nina year as well means that the convective storm season is something to watch out for in the US too. And we're just approaching really the beginning of that at this time of year, aren't we? Where it's generally considered to be a concern, but I know there's already some forecasters out there saying it's going to certainly have elevated levels of activity. Do you think all of this, and with the backdrop of COVID still overhanging the industry, just makes hedging more important, more essential for reinsurers and ILS funds?
I think so, yeah. I mean, and when I look at hedging, I think of it in two different ways. You know, first, there is the, you know, the well-planned, disciplined offset in which you are, you know, worried about things like basis risk, or you have, you know, key scenarios that you're worried about. And then I think increasingly, and been saying this for years, and every year it becomes, you know, more visible, is hedging for the things that you just don't think are going to happen. You know, in the past 4 years of leading PCS, we've seen a number of things that nobody, thought were possible. In 2016, mm-hmm. Fort McMurray was the largest wildfire we had in the U.S. or Canada by insured loss. Surprise number one. Surprise number two, it's no longer in the top five. So wildfire is a much different risk than it was 5 years ago. The Turkish quake last year was the first quake we did since launching in Turkey, but it's the fourth cat we've done. So when we did our historicals for Turkey, everything we had was quake and flood. 2016 was terror. 2017 was Istanbul hail. Nobody had been thinking about those. Here we go, right? There's one of these after the other, these cats that are either larger than anyone thought they could get or that had never happened before and now arise. I mean, in 2019 and 20, you can add up more than $5 billion of insured loss from strike, riot, civil commotion in Chile and the United States. I mean, that was not on anybody's radar, $5 billion in America's riot in, less than 12 months. So, these are the factors where, rather than thinking about, the contemplated aligned basis risk mitigated hedge, there might be some value in some blunt force hedges that pay out to solve a problem. Right. There are cases where you're looking to offset your loss or manage your exposure. And then there are cases where, something happens and an injection of capital would just really be helpful. I think there's a certain value to that latter category that's often been overlooked.
And certainly at this point in the pandemic, with no sign of it going away and continuing concerns over some of the biggest economies in the world as well. I guess finally, I'd just ask you, do you think we'll still be talking about COVID on our chats in a year's time?
I think so. We certainly, we're looking at a vaccination year right now, which still itself has a certain amount of uncertainty associated with it. But also there is a certain amount of runway associated with it. That is seemingly a year-long discussion where, guys like me, kind of lower priority folks within the broad scheme of vaccination aren't likely to see anything. I think the original forecasts were, August, September? Mm-hmm. And that seems less realistic by the day, which honestly, I think we've got to be fair here. We're talking about a global effort, loosely coordinated because countries don't always work well together, to protect billions of people from infection. It's gonna slip a couple of months. I'm good with that. I get that. I'm a realist. But what it also means is, healthier, younger folks probably aren't gonna be vaccinated in August. All right, if we're waiting to the end of the year, that's fine. That's nature of the beast, but it just turns this into a year-long endeavor, presumably with some spillover of impact, social or economic, into 2022. We just have to prepare for that, and that's where my head is right now. I'm thinking more about what this year looks like and what a 2022 resumption of what historically was business as usual, at least to the extent that we want to keep doing that. This year is going to be figuring out, I think, how to come back stronger in 2022.
I think everybody's focused on that, and certainly I look forward to being able to meet up with people again, and it's a shame we can't be in New York this year for this event. Thank you very much, Tom. I appreciate your time again. And to everyone watching, please do watch Tom's earlier video as well, which is available on the event website too. So thank you, Tom. Thanks for the support, and I'll catch up with you soon.
Thanks, Steve. Sounds good.